2. Could it be that I am mistaken in this belief? 3. Would I come to the same conclusion about some other person in a similar situation? 4. Why should I continue to act and feel as if this were true if there is no good reason to believe it? Don't just pass these questions by casually. Wrestle with them. Think hard on them. Get emotional about them. Can you see that you have cheated yourself and sold yourself short, not because of a fact, but only because of some stupid belief? If so, try to arouse some indignation or even anger. Indignation and anger can sometimes act as liberators from false ideas. Alfred Adler got mad at himself and at his teacher and was enabled to throw off a negative definition of himself. This experience is not uncommon. An old farmer said he quit tobacco for good one day when he discovered he had left his tobacco home and started to walk the 2 miles for it. On the way, he saw that he was being used in a humiliating way by a habit. He got mad, turned around, went back to the field, and never smoked again. Clarence Darrow, the famous attorney, said his success started the day that he got mad when he attempted to secure a mortgage to buy a house. Just as the transaction was about to be completed, the lender's wife spoke up and said, "Don't be a fool. He will never make enough money to pay it off." Darrow himself had had serious doubts about the same thing. But something happened when he heard her remark. He became indignant, both at the woman and at himself, and determined he would be a success. A businessman friend of mine had a very similar experience. A failure at 40, he continually worried about how things would come out, about his own inadequacies, and whether or not he would be able to complete each business venture. Fearful and anxious, he was attempting to purchase some machinery on credit when the seller's wife objected. She did not believe he would ever be able to pay for the machinery. At first, his hopes were dashed, but then he became indignant. Who was he to be pushed around like that? Who was he to skulk through the world, continually fearful of failure? The experience awakened something within him, some new self, and at once he saw that this woman's remark, as well as his own opinion of himself, was an affront to this something. He had no money, no credit, and no way to accomplish what he wanted, but he found a way. And within 3 years, he was more successful than he had ever dreamed of being, not in one business, but in 3. The power of deep desire. Rational thought, to be effective in changing belief and behavior, must be accompanied with deep feeling and desire. Picture to yourself what you would like to be and have, and assume for the moment that such things might be possible. Arouse a deep desire for these things. Become enthusiastic about them. Dwell on them, and keep going over them in your mind. Your present negative beliefs were formed by thought plus feelings. Generate enough emotion or deep feeling, and your new thoughts and ideas will cancel them out. If you will analyze this, you will see that you are using a process you have often used before: worry. The only difference is you change your goals from negative to positive. When you worry, you first of all picture some undesirable future outcome or goal very vividly in your imagination. You use no effort or willpower, but you keep dwelling on the end result. You keep thinking about it, dwelling on it, picturing it to yourself as a possibility. You play with the idea that it might happen. This constant repetition and thinking in terms of possibilities makes the end result appear more and more real to you. After time, appropriate emotions are automatically generated. Fear, anxiety, discouragement, all these are appropriate to the undesirable end result you are worrying about. Now change the goal picture, and you can as easily generate good emotions. Constantly picturing to yourself and dwelling on a desirable end result will also make the possibility seem more real. And again, appropriate emotions of enthusiasm, cheerfulness, encouragement, and happiness will automatically be generated. In forming good emotional habits and in breaking bad ones, said Dr. Knight Dunlap, we have to deal primarily with thought and thought habits. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. What rational thought can and cannot do. Remember that your automatic mechanism can as easily function as a failure mechanism as it can as a success mechanism, depending on the data you give it to process and the goals you set for it. It is basically a goal-striving mechanism. The goals it works on are up to you. Many of us unconsciously and unwittingly, by holding negative attitudes and habitually picturing failure to ourselves in our imagination, set up goals of failure. Also remember that your automatic mechanism does not reason about or question the data you feed it. It merely processes it and reacts appropriately to it. It is very important that the automatic mechanism be given true facts concerning the environment. This is the job of conscious, rational thought, to know the truth, to form correct evaluations, estimations, and opinions. In this connection, most of us are prone to underestimate ourselves and overestimate the nature of the difficulty facing us. Always think of what you have to do as easy, and it will become so, said Emile Cui, the psychologist and pharmacist who introduced a popular method of psychotherapy and self-improvement based on optimistic autosuggestion. In the same vein, psychologist Daniel W. Jocelyn wrote in his book, Why Be Tired? I have made extensive experiments to discover the common causes of that conscious effort which freezes the thinking mind. Practically always, it seems to be due to the tendency to exaggerate the difficulty and importance of your mental labors, to take them too seriously in fear they will find you incapable. People who are eloquent in casual conversation become imbeciles when they mount the speaker's platform. You simply must learn that if you can interest the neighbor, you can interest all the neighbors or the world and not be frozen by magnitudes. Matt Fury commentary. A person who fears public speaking usually has no fear of talking openly with trusted friends. The fact that you can speak openly with friends means you have the skill of public speaking. Now all you need to do is bring the same person who speaks easily with friends into the room where you will then speak openly before a large crowd of perceived friends. Picture yourself speaking openly with friends, then amplify the same imagery in your mind to encompass a larger group of friends, and public speaking will become easy for you. Now back to Dr. Maltz. You never know until you try. It is the job of rational, conscious thought to examine and analyze incoming messages, to accept those that are true and reject those that are untrue. Many people are bowled over by the chance remark of a friend, such as, "You do not look so well this morning." If they are rejected or snubbed by someone, They blindly swallow the so-called fact that this means they are an inferior person. Most of us are subjected to negative suggestions every day. If our conscious mind is working and on the job, we do not have to accept them blindly. "It ain't necessarily so" is a good motto. It is the job of the conscious, rational mind to form logical and correct conclusions. "I failed once in the past, so I will probably fail in the future" is neither logical nor rational. To conclude, "I can't" in advance without trying, and in the absence of any evidence to support the inevitability of failure, is not rational. We should be more like the man who was asked if he could play the piano. "I don't know," he said. "What do you mean you don't know?" he was asked. "I have never tried," he replied. Decide what you want, not what you don't want. It is the job of conscious, rational thought to decide what you want, select the goals you wish to achieve, and concentrate on these rather than on what you do not want. To spend time and effort concentrating on what you do not want is not rational. When President Eisenhower was General Eisenhower in World War II, he was asked what would have been the effect on the Allied cause if the invasion troops had been thrown back into the sea from the beaches of Italy. "It would have been very bad," he said, "but I never allow my mind to think in that way." Keep your eye on the ball. It is the job of your conscious mind to pay strict attention to the task at hand, to what you are doing and what is going on around you, so that these incoming sensory messages can keep your automatic mechanism currently advised of the environment and allow it to respond spontaneously. In baseball parlance, you must keep your eye on the ball. It is not the job of your conscious, rational mind, however, to create or to do the job at hand. We get into trouble when we either neglect to use conscious thinking in the way that it is meant to be used, or when we attempt to use it in a way that it was never meant to be used. We cannot squeeze creative thought out of the creative mechanism by making conscious effort. We cannot do the job to be done by making strained conscious efforts. And because we try and cannot, we become concerned, anxious, frustrated. The automatic mechanism is unconscious. We cannot see the wheels turning. We cannot know what is taking place beneath the surface. And because it works spontaneously in reacting to present and current needs, we can have no intimation or certified guarantee in advance that it will come up with the answer. We are forced into a position of trust, and only by trusting and acting do we receive signs and wonders. In short, conscious, rational thought selects the goal, gathers information, concludes, evaluates, estimates, and starts the wheels in motion. It is not, however, responsible for results. We must learn to do our work, act on the best assumptions available, and leave results to take care of themselves. At this point, you are welcome to pause the audio program and consider some of the key points that you've heard articulated in this chapter, as well as to consider some experiences you've had throughout your life that bring the concepts and principles to life for you. Chapter 6. Relax and let your success mechanism work for you. Stress has become a popular word in our language. We speak of this as the age of stress. Worry, anxiety, insomnia, stomach ulcers have become accepted as a necessary part of the world in which we live. Yet I am convinced that it does not have to be that way. we could relieve ourselves of a vast load of care, anxiety, and worry if we could but recognize the simple truth that our Creator made ample provisions for us to live successfully in this or any other age by providing us with a built-in creative mechanism. Our trouble is that we ignore the automatic creative mechanism and try to do everything and solve all our problems by conscious thought or forebrain thinking. The forebrain is comparable to the operator of a computer or any other type of servo mechanism. It is with the forebrain that we think I and feel our sense of identity. It is with the forebrain that we exercise imagination or set goals. We use the forebrain to gather information, make observations, and evaluate incoming sense data, form judgments. But the forebrain cannot create. It cannot do the job to be done, any more than the operator of a computer can do the work. It is the job of the forebrain to pose problems and to identify them. But by its very nature, it was never engineered to solve problems. Don't be too careful. Yet that is precisely what modern man tries to do. Solve all his problems by conscious thought. Jesus said, "Which of you by taking thought can add one cubit unto his stature?" Dr. Norbert Wiener tells us that man cannot even perform such a simple operation as picking up a pen from a table by conscious thought or will. Because modern man does depend almost entirely on his forebrain, he becomes too careful, too anxious, and too fearful of results, and the advice of Jesus to take no thought for the morrow, or of St. Paul to be careful in nothing, is regarded as impractical nonsense. Yet this is precisely the advice that William James, Dean of American Psychologists, gave us years ago, if we would but have listened to him. In his little essay, The Gospel of Relaxation, collected in his book on vital reserves, he said that modern man was too tense, too concerned for results, too anxious. This was in 1899, and that there was a better and easier way. If we wish our trains of ideation and volition to be copious and varied and effective, we must form the habit of freeing them from the inhibitive influence of reflection upon them, of egoistic preoccupation about their results. Such a habit, like other habits, can be formed. Prudence and duty and self-regard, emotions of ambition and emotions of anxiety have, of course, a needful part to play in our lives. But confine them as far as possible to the occasions when you are making your general resolutions and deciding on your plans of campaign, and keep them out of the details. When once a decision is reached and execution is the order of the day, dismiss absolutely all responsibility and care about the outcome. Unclamp, in a word, your intellectual and practical machinery, and let it run free, and the service it will do you will be twice as good. Victory by Surrender. Later, in his famous Gifford lectures, collected in The Varieties of Religious Experience, James cited example after example of persons who had tried unsuccessfully for years to rid themselves of anxieties, worries, inferiorities, guilt feelings, by making conscious efforts, only to find that success finally came when they gave up the struggle consciously and stopped trying to solve their problems by conscious thought. Under these circumstances, said James, the way to success, as vouched for by innumerable authentic personal narrations, is by surrender, passivity, not activity. Relaxation, not intentness, should be now the rule. Give up the feeling of responsibility. Let go your hold. Resign the care of your destiny to higher powers. Be genuinely indifferent as to what becomes of it all. It is but giving your private, convulsive self a rest and finding that a greater self is there. The results, slow or sudden, or great or small, of the combined optimism and expectancy, the regenerative phenomena which ensue on the abandonment of effort, remain firm facts of human nature. The secret of creative thinking and creative doing. Proof of the fact that what we have been saying is true can be seen in the experience of writers, inventors, and other creative workers. Invariably, they tell us that creative ideas are not consciously thought out by forebrain thinking, but come automatically, spontaneously, and somewhat like a bolt out of the blue when the conscious mind has let go of the problem and is engaged in thinking of something else. These creative ideas do not come willy-nilly without some preliminary conscious thought about the problem. All the evidence points to the conclusion that in order to receive an inspiration or a hunch, the person must first of all be intensely interested in solving a particular problem or securing a particular answer. He must think about it consciously, gather all the information he can on the subject, consider all the possible courses of action, and above all, he must have a burning desire to solve the problem. But after he has defined the problem, sees in his imagination the desired end result, secured all the information and facts that he can, then additional struggling, fretting, and worrying over it does not help, but seems to hinder the solution. Henry Fair, the famous Swiss scientist, said that practically all his good ideas came to him when he was not actively engaged in work on a problem, and that most of the discoveries of his contemporaries were made when they were away from their workbench, so to speak. It is well known that when Thomas A. Edison was stymied by a problem, he would lie down and take a short nap. Charles Darwin, telling how an intuitional flash came to him suddenly, after months of conscious thinking had failed to give him the ideas he needed for The Origin of Species, wrote, "I can remember the very spot in the road, whilst in my carriage, when to my joy the solution occurred to me." Lennox Riley Lore, former president of the National Broadcasting Company, wrote in the American magazine how ideas that had helped him in business came to him. "Ideas, I find, come most readily when you are doing something that keeps the mind alert without putting too much strain upon it. Shaving, driving a car, sawing a plank, or fishing or hunting, for instance. Or engaging with some friend in stimulating conversation. Some of my best ideas came from information picked up casually and entirely unrelated to my work." C.G. Suits, who was the chief of research at General Electric, said that nearly all the discoveries in research laboratories came as hunches during a period of relaxation, following a period of intensive thinking and fact-gathering. Bertrand Russell wrote in his book, The Conquest of Happiness, "I have found, for example, that if I have to write upon some rather difficult topic, the best plan is to think about it with very great intensity, the greatest intensity of which I am capable, for a few hours or days, and at the end of that time give orders, so to speak, that the work is to proceed underground. After some months, I return consciously to the topic and find that the work has been done. Before I had discovered this technique, I used to spend the intervening months worrying because I was making no progress. I arrived at the solution none the sooner for this worry, and the intervening months were wasted, whereas now I can devote them to other pursuits. Matt Fury commentary. Many creators report that they get their best ideas either in the shower, while walking along the beach, or otherwise being in or around water. Perhaps the flow of water leads to the flow of ideas. The other activity that often leads to creative insights is sleeping. If you have a question you'd like an answer to, or a project you're working on that you'd like to accomplish with greater ease, you can instruct your mind before going to bed to be open to useful information and to remember it upon awakening, keeping a notepad and pen on your nightstand to record the insights as they come is a good idea. When you use this approach, you can quickly find yourself getting ideas that greatly surpass anything that comes to you while awake. Now back to Dr. Maltz. You are a creative worker. The mistake we make is assuming that this process of unconscious cerebration is reserved for writers, inventors, and creative workers. We are all creative workers, whether we are stay-at-home parents, school teachers, students, salesmen, or businessmen. We all have the same success mechanism within us, and it will work in solving personal problems, running a business, or selling goods, just as it will in writing a story or inventing. Bertrand Russell recommended that the same method he used in his writing be employed by his readers in solving their mundane personal problems. Dr. J.B. Rhine, the botanist and author of Extrasensory Perception and Parapsychology, Frontier Science of the Mind, said that he was inclined to think that what we call genius is a process, a natural way in which the human mind works to solve any problem, but that we mistakenly apply the term genius only when the process is used to write a book or paint a picture. The secret of natural behavior and skill. The success mechanism within you can work in the same way to produce creative doing as it does to produce creative ideas. Skill in any performance, whether it be in sports, in playing the piano, in conversation, or in selling merchandise, consists not in painfully and consciously thinking out each action as it is performed, but in relaxing and letting the job do itself through you. Creative performance is spontaneous and natural, as opposed to self-conscious and studied. The most skilled pianist in the world could never play a simple composition if he tried to consciously think out just which finger should strike which key while he was playing. He has given conscious thought to this matter previously while learning and has practiced until his actions become automatic and habit-like. He was able to become a skilled performer only when he reached the point where he could cease conscious effort and turn the matter of playing over to the unconscious habit mechanism that is a part of the success mechanism. Don't jam your creative machinery. Conscious effort inhibits and jams the automatic creative mechanism. The reason some people are self-conscious and awkward in social situations is simply that they are too consciously concerned, too anxious about doing the right thing. They are painfully conscious of every move they make. Every action is thought out. Every word spoken is calculated for its effect. We speak of such persons as inhibited, and rightly so. But it would be more true were we to say that the person is not inhibited, but that the person has inhibited his own creative mechanism. If these people could let go stop trying, not care, and give no thought to the matter of their behavior, they could act creatively, spontaneously, and be themselves. Matt Fury commentary. When you set a goal, it's very important to keep in mind that most of the time you will be in journey mode. This means you will be focused on the process and the actions you need to take to get where you want to go most of the time. If your goal is to climb Mount Everest and you are only thinking about being at the top, you jam your success mechanism in the present. You've got to take care of each step along the way. Focus on the journey the majority of the time, and occasionally, once or twice per day when you visualize, tune into the goal. Then get back into journey mode and simply turn your goal over to your subconscious or success mechanism to guide you there without effort. People who want to improve their financial situation must heed the same advice. If you continually obsess about where you are as well as where you want to be financially, you're less likely to get there. Program the goal, then get busy on the process. And if you don't know the process yet, give yourself space to allow the process of how to come to you. The how will come to you when you're relaxed, not when you're tense or trying to force your way through the process. Now back to Dr. Maltz. 5 rules for freeing your creative machinery. 1. Do your worrying before you place your bet, not after the wheel starts turning. I am indebted to a business executive whose weakness was roulette, and for the just mentioned expression, which worked like magic in helping him overcome worry, and at the same time function more creatively and successfully, I happen to quote him the advice of William James, mentioned earlier, to the effect that emotions of anxiety have their place in planning and deciding on a course of action. But when once a decision is reached, and execution is the order of the day, dismiss absolutely all responsibility and care about the outcome. Unclamp, in a word, your intellectual and practical machinery and let it run free. Several weeks later, he burst into my office as enthusiastic over his discovery as a schoolboy who has discovered his first love. "It hit me all of a sudden," he said. "During a visit to Las Vegas, I've been trying it, and it works." "What hit you and what works?" I asked. "That advice of William James's. It didn't make too much of an impression when you told me, but while I was playing roulette, it came back to me. I noticed any number of people who appeared not to worry at all before placing their bets. Apparently, odds meant nothing to them. But once the wheel started turning, they froze up and began to worry whether their number would come up or not. How silly," I thought. "If they want to worry or be concerned or figure odds, the time to do that is before the decision is made to place a bet. There is something you can do about it then by thinking about it. You can figure out the best odds possible, or decide not to take the risk at all. But after the bets are placed and the wheel starts turning, you might as well relax and enjoy it. Thinking about it is not going to do one bit of good and is wasted energy." Then I got to thinking that I myself had been doing exactly the same thing in my business and in my personal life. I often made decisions or embarked upon courses of action without adequate preparation, without considering all the risks involved and the best possible alternative. But after I had set the wheels in motion, so to speak, I continually worried over how it would come out, whether I had done the right thing, I made a decision right then that in the future I would do all my worrying, all my forebrain thinking, before a decision was made, and that after making a decision and setting the wheels in motion, I would dismiss absolutely all responsibility and care about the outcome. Believe it or not, it works. I not only feel better, sleep better, and work better, but my business is running much smoother. I also discovered that the same principle works in 100 different little personal ways. For example, I used to worry and fume about having to go to the dentist and other unpleasant tasks. Then I said to myself, "This is silly. You know the unpleasantness involved before you make the decision to go. If the unpleasantness is all that important to cause so much concern and not worth the worry involved, you can simply decide not to go. But if the decision is that the trip is worth a little unpleasantness, and a definite decision is made to go, then forget about it. Consider the risk before the wheel starts turning. I used to worry the night before I had to make a speech at a board meeting. Then I said to myself, I'm either going to make the speech or I'm not. If the decision is to make it, then there's no need in considering not making it or trying to mentally run away from it. I have discovered that much nervousness and anxiety is caused by mentally trying to escape or run away from something that you have decided to go through with physically. If the decision is made to go through with it, not to run away physically, why mentally keep considering or hoping for escape? I used to detest social gatherings and go along only to please my wife or for business reasons. I went, but mentally I resisted it and was usually pretty grumpy and uncommunicative. Then I decided that if the decision was to go along physically, I might as well go along mentally and dismiss all thoughts of resistance. Last night, I not only went to what I would formerly have called a stupid social gathering, but I was surprised to find myself thoroughly enjoying it. 2. Form the habit of consciously responding to the present moment. Consciously practice the habit of taking no anxious thought for tomorrow by giving all your attention to the present moment. Your creative mechanism cannot function or work tomorrow. It can only function in the present, today. Make long-range plans for tomorrow, but don't try to live in tomorrow or in the past. Creative living means responding and reacting to environment spontaneously. Your creative mechanism can respond appropriately and successfully to present environment only if you have your full attention on present environment and give it information concerning what is happening now. Plan all you want to for the future. Prepare for it. But don't worry about how you will react tomorrow or even 5 minutes from now. Your creative mechanism will react appropriately in the now if you pay attention to what is happening now. It will do the same tomorrow. It cannot react successfully to what may happen, but to what is happening. Live in daytight compartments. Dr. William Osler, author of A Way of Life, said that one simple habit, which could be formed like any other habit, was the sole secret of his happiness and success in life. Live life in daytight compartments, he advised his students. Look neither forward nor backward beyond a 24-hour cycle. Live today as best you can. By living today well, you do the most within your power to make tomorrow better. William James, commenting on this same philosophy as a cardinal principle of both psychology and religion for curing worry, said. Of St. Catherine of Genoa, it is said that she took cognizance of things only as they were presented to her in succession, moment by moment. To her holy soul, the divine moment was the present moment, and when the present moment was estimated in itself and in its relations, and when the duty that was involved in it was accomplished, it was permitted to pass away as if it had never been, and to give way to the faces and duties of the moment which came after. Alcoholics Anonymous uses the same principle when they say, "Don't try to stop drinking forever. Merely say, I will not drink today." Stop, look, and listen. Practice becoming more consciously aware of your present environment. What sights, sounds, odors are present in your environment right now that you are not conscious of? Consciously practice looking and listening. Become alert to the feel of objects. How long since you have really felt the pavement beneath your feet as you walk? The Native Americans and the early pioneers had to be alert to the sights and sounds and feelings of their environment in order to survive. So does modern man, but for a different reason. Not because of physical dangers, but because of the dangers of nervous disorders that come from confused thinking, from failure to live creatively and spontaneously, and to respond appropriately to environment. This becoming more aware of what is happening now and attempting to respond only to what is happening now has almost magical results in relieving the jitters. The next time you feel yourself tensing up, becoming jittery and nervous, pull yourself up short and say, "What is there here and now that I should respond to, that I can do something about?" A great deal of nervousness is caused from unwittingly trying to do something that cannot be done here or now. You are then geared for action or for doing, which cannot take place. Keep constantly in mind that the job of your creative mechanism is to respond appropriately to present environment, here and now. Many times, if we do not stop and think about this, we continue to react automatically to some past environment. We do not react to the present moment and the present situation, but to some similar event out of the past. In short, we do not react to reality, but to a fiction. Full recognition of this and realization of what you're doing can frequently bring about an amazingly quick cure. Don't fight straw men out of the past. For example, a patient of mine became jittery and anxious in business meetings, theaters, church, or in any formal gathering. Groups of people were the common denominator. Without realizing it, he was attempting to react to some environment out of his past where groups of people were a significant factor. He remembered that, when he was a child in elementary school, he had wet his pants, and a cruel school teacher had called him up in front of the class and humiliated him. He reacted with feelings of humiliation and shame. Now, one factor in the situation, groups of people, was reacted to as if it were the entire past situation. When he was able to see that he was acting as if he were a 10-year-old schoolboy, as if every gathering were an elementary school class, and as if every group leader were the cruel school teacher, his anxiety disappeared. Other typical examples are the woman who responds to every man she meets as if he were some individual man out of her past. The man who reacts to every person in authority as if he were some individual authority out of his past. 3. Try to do only one thing at a time. Another cause of confusion and the resulting feelings of nervousness, hurry, and anxiety is the absurd habit of trying to do many things at one time. The student studies and watches TV simultaneously. The businessman, instead of concentrating on and only trying to do the one letter that he's presently dictating, is thinking in the back of his mind of all the things he should accomplish today, or perhaps this week, and unconsciously trying mentally to accomplish them all at once. The habit is particularly insidious because it is seldom recognized for what it is. When we feel jittery or worried or anxious in thinking of the great amount of work that lies before us, the jittery feelings are not caused by the work, but by our mental attitude, which is, I ought to be able to do this all at once. We become nervous because we are trying to do the impossible, and thereby making futility and frustration inevitable. The truth is, we can only do one thing at a time. Realizing this, fully convincing ourselves of this simple and obvious truth, enables us to mentally stop trying to do the things that lie next, and to concentrate all our awareness, all our responsiveness, on this one thing we are doing now. When we work with this attitude, we are relaxed. We are free from the feelings of hurry and anxiety, and we are able to concentrate and think at our best. The Lesson of the Hourglass. Dr. James Gordon Gilkey preached a sermon in 1944 called Gaining Emotional Poise, which was reprinted in Reader's Digest and became a classic almost overnight. He had found, through many years of counseling, that one of the main causes of breakdown, worry, and all sorts of other personal problems was this bad mental habit of feeling that you should be doing many things now. Looking at the hourglass on his desk, he had an inspiration. Just as only one grain of sand could pass through the hourglass, so could we only do one thing at a time. It is not the job, but the way we insist on thinking of the job that causes the trouble. Most of us feel hurried and harried, said Dr. Gilkey, because we form a false mental picture of our duties, obligations, and responsibilities. There seem to be a dozen different things pressing in on us at any given moment, a dozen different things to do, a dozen different problems to solve, a dozen different strains to endure. No matter how hurried or harried our existence may be, said Dr. Gilkey, this mental picture is entirely false. Even on the busiest day, the crowded hours come to us one moment at a time. No matter how many problems, tasks, or strains we face, they always come to us in single file, which is the only way they can come. To get a true mental picture, he suggested visualizing an hourglass, with the many grains of sand dropping one by one. This mental picture will bring emotional poise, just as the false mental picture will bring emotional unrest. Another similar mental device that I have found very helpful to my patients is telling them, your success mechanism can help you do any job, perform any task, solve any problem. Think of yourself as feeding jobs and problems to your success mechanism as a scientist feeds a problem to a computer. The hopper to your success mechanism can handle only one job at a time. Just as a computer cannot give the right answer if three different problems are mixed up and fed in at the same time, neither can your own success mechanism. Ease off on the pressure. Stop trying to cram into the machinery more than one job at a time. Matt Fury commentary. You can have many goals, but concentrating on just one at a time will help you accomplish far more than attempting to focus on many at once. Get the fire of desire started within, being single-minded about one goal, and the flame will naturally spread to the others without you forcing it. Now back to Dr. Maltz. 4. Sleep on it. If you have been wrestling with the problem all day without making any apparent progress, try dismissing it from your mind and put off making a decision until you've had a chance to sleep on it. Remember that your creative mechanism works best when there is not too much interference from your conscious eye. In sleep, the creative mechanism has an ideal opportunity to work independently of conscious interference, if you have previously started the wheels turning. Remember the fairy story, The Elves and the Shoemaker. The shoemaker found that if he cut out the leather and laid out the patterns before retiring, little elves came and actually put the shoes together for him while he was sleeping. Many creative workers have used a very similar technique. Mrs. Thomas A. Edison has said that each evening her husband would go over in his mind those things that he hoped to accomplish the next day. Sometimes he would make a list of the jobs he wanted to do and problems that he hoped to solve. Sir Walter Scott is reported to have said to himself, whenever his ideas would not gel, "Never mind, I shall have it at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning." Vladimir Bekhterev, the Russian neurologist who is considered to be the father of objective psychology, said, "It happened several times when I concentrated in the evening on a subject which I had put into poetic shape, that in the morning I had only to take my pen and the words flowed, as it were, spontaneously. I had only to polish them later." Edison's well-known catnaps were far more than mere respites from fatigue. In The Psychology of the Inventor, Joseph Rossman said, "When stumped by something, he would stretch out in his Menlo workshop and, half dozing, get an idea from his dream mind to help him around the difficulty." J.B. Priestley dreamed 3 essays, complete in every detail: The Berkshire Beast, The Strange Outfitter, and The Dream. Frederick Temple, an Archbishop of Canterbury, said, "All decisive thinking goes on behind the scenes. I seldom know when it takes place. Much of it certainly during sleep." Henry Ward Beecher once preached every day for 18 months. His method? He kept a number of ideas hatching, and each night before retiring would select an incubating idea and stir it up by thinking intensely about it. The next morning it would have fitted itself together for a sermon. August Kekulé's discovery of the secret of the benzene molecule while he slept, Otto Loewi's Nobel Prize-winning discovery that active chemicals are involved in the action of nerves, and Robert Louis Stevenson's brownies, which he said gave him all his plot ideas while sleeping, are all well known. Less well known is the fact that many businessmen use the same technique. For example, Henry Cobbs, who started his business in the early 1930s with a $10 bill and built a multi-million dollar mail-order fruit business, kept a notebook by his bedside to jot down creative ideas immediately upon wakening. Vic Pocker arrived in America from Hungary with no money and unable to speak English. He got a job as a welder, went to night school to learn English, and saved his money. His savings were wiped out in the Great Depression, but in 1932, he started a small welding shop of his own, which he called steel fabricators, and which became a profitable million-dollar firm. "I've discovered you have to make your own breaks," he said. "Sometimes in my dreams, I get ideas for licking problems and wake up all excited. Many's the time I've gotten out of bed at 2 a.m. and gone down to the shop to see if an idea would work." 5. Relax while you work. Practice exercise. In Chapter 4, you learned how to induce physical and mental relaxation while resting. Continue with the daily practice in relaxation and you will become more and more proficient. In the meantime, you can induce something of that relaxed feeling and the relaxed attitude while going about your daily activities, if you will form the habit of mentally remembering the nice relaxed feeling that you induced. Stop occasionally during the day. It need only take a moment, and remember in detail the sensations of relaxation. Remember how your arms felt, your legs, back, neck, face. Sometimes forming a mental picture of yourself lying in bed or sitting relaxed and limp in an easy chair helps to recall the relaxed sensations. Mentally repeating to yourself several times, "I feel more and more relaxed," also helps. Practice this remembering faithfully several times each day. You will be surprised at how much it reduces fatigue and how much better you are able to handle situations. For by relaxing and maintaining a relaxed attitude, you remove those excessive states of concern, tension, and anxiety, which interfere with the efficient operation of your creative mechanism. In time, your relaxed attitude will become a habit, and you will no longer need to consciously practice it. At this point, you are welcome to pause the audio program and consider some of the key points that you've heard articulated in this chapter, as well as to consider some experiences you've had throughout your life that bring the concepts and principles to life for you. Chapter 7. You Can Acquire the Habit of Happiness. In this chapter, I discuss the subject of happiness, not from a philosophical, but from a medical standpoint. Dr. John A. Schindler defines happiness as a state of mind in which our thinking is pleasant a good share of the time. From a medical standpoint, and also from an ethical standpoint, I do not believe that simple definition can be improved on. Happiness is good medicine. Happiness is native to the human mind and its physical machine. We think better, perform better, feel better, and are healthier when we are happy. Even our physical sense organs work better. Russian psychologist K. Ketchiev tested people when they were thinking pleasant and unpleasant thoughts. He found that when thinking pleasant thoughts, they could see better, taste, smell, and hear better, and detect finer differences in touch. Dr. William Bates proved that eyesight improves immediately when the individual is thinking pleasant thoughts or visualizing pleasant scenes. Vision educator Margaret Corbett found that memory is greatly improved and that the mind is relaxed when the subject is thinking pleasant thoughts. Psychosomatic medicine has proved that our stomach, liver, heart, and all our internal organs function better when we are happy. Thousands of years ago, wise old King Solomon said in his Proverbs, "A merry heart doeth good like a medicine, but a broken spirit drieth up the bones." It is significant, too, that both Judaism and Christianity prescribes joy, rejoicing, thankfulness, cheerfulness as a means toward righteousness and the good life. Harvard psychologists studied the correlation between happiness and criminality and concluded that the old Dutch proverb, "Happy people are